Okay, so I wanted to jump in. The vote was to explore the notion of the concept of divinity. This is sort of a theoretical topic, but as we'll see, it has profound practical implications. And this is a really contemporary question that bears not only on our theology, but on all sorts of encounters between Jews and members of other faith communities. There was a time in history when people predicted the demise of religious communities. Not too long ago, the rise of secularism, the rise of science, not just as a way of procuring knowledge, but as a way of thinking about the world. And if you go back about 100 years, moderns said this whole religious superstition thing, who needs it anymore, it's going to fall away. I mean, take a look 100 years later and look at the map today and look at the incredible rise of religious communities. Look at not just Islam, but especially Islam, but really across the board. It's stunning to see the way in which religion has not only failed to die, but has achieved a certain resurgence. It's incredible to see. And in this increasingly religious world, at least in many quarters, what we have now is a phenomenon of Jews, of course, as minority cultures in everywhere but Israel, encountering people from other faith communities. And the question is a practical one, the question is a theological one. How do we engage with people that we fundamentally disagree with? And this has become one of the great challenges of the world today. Of course, it's not just a brand new question. This is something we've been struggling with for thousands of years. So what I'm going to do is to divide our study into a couple of sections. You could have divided it otherwise. What we're going to do today is Christianity. Next week, we're going to look at what seems like an easier question, which is Islam. But we'll see, it's going to be very interesting as well. And then what I'm hoping to do is to then turn to some of the other Eastern religions. What does Judaism have to say about Buddhism? Right? What do we even know about Buddhism? What do we know about Hinduism? And so on and so forth. What sort of approaches do we find in the Jewish tradition to these other faith communities? Those who are just walking in, just a heads up, there's an AP right next door, so we're trying to be mindful so that we don't have to relocate for our class today. Okay, so what I'm going to do today is we're going to cover a lot of ground, so I'm going to move a little bit quickly, and we're going to have it's a fascinating kind of study, and I want to look at different models of the Jewish attitude toward Christianity historically. So that's sort of what we're going to look at today. A couple of the sources that we're going to be discussing, I've had the opportunity to discuss with, not specifically for this class, but in general, with some Christian friends. There's some really interesting background here. The material itself is fascinating. What I want to do is to divide our study into a couple of different schools of thought. The first one I want to look at is what I call the exclusivist school. When I say exclusivist school, I mean notion of basically seeing Christianity as idolatrous, seeing Christianity as theologically radically inconsistent with the Jewish conception of monotheism. That's really what I want to tackle. If anyone's interested in reading more, this is a book by Dr. Alan Brill. Dr. Alan Brill used to teach at Yeshiva University. He's now at Seton Hall University, and he has he occupies the chair of, let me get this right, one second, the Sister Rose Thering Chair in Theology at Seton Hall University. What? Sure. So he is a Jewish scholar who is a traditional Jew who knows a lot about not just Judaism, but a lot about Christianity. He knows a lot about Islam. He knows a lot about all sorts of different faith communities. And he's actually gone on these interfaith encounters, whether missions or really academic conferences and opportunities for there to be an exchange of ideas. He's very broad. So some of the sources, not all the sources, but some of the sources I'm drawing from his book as well. One of the fascinating phenomena that we find with regard to this topic, as we look at the exclusivist school in particular, is the phenomenon of censorship. When we take a look at classical Jewish texts, as we have Jews writing about or being published about the faith communities that were in the majority, we find often a discrepancy between the initial authorship or the content of what was written to begin with and how the book was actually put out there in a particular society. We know this from our own prayers. Aleinu used to include Shehem Mishtachavim Lehevel Varek, that they bow to emptiness and to nothingness, Umitbalim Akel Lo Yoshia, and they pray. It's a clear reference. It was understood at least as a clear reference to the Christians. And what happened? Right? What did we do? Anyone know what the practice was in many Christian Jewish communities when we got to the word varik and emptiness? It's the same gematria as Yeshu for Jesus. And what did the Jews do?
Spit.
They spat. That's right. Okay, excellent timing. They spat and I sat on the ground. So, for obvious reasons, in a Christian milieu, as Jews were spitting on the ground and they were declaring the Christian gods to be completely nonsensical and utterly meaningless and devoid of any value, obviously that wasn't necessarily a popular position for a community that was being terribly persecuted by the Christian majority in Christian Europe. So this became a problem. And you have this phenomenon not only with regard to our prayers, and by the way, then the question is, so do we add it back in? If the only reason we dropped a text was because of fear of censorship, do you then include it back in? And the minhag, of course, in most sidurim is to put it in parentheses. In other words, not to decide, right? We're just not going there. And we'll let the rabbis in each community decide what the practice should be, or the communities will decide, or what have you. We find this phenomenon with regard to many, many texts, especially in medieval Christian milieus, and in particular with regard to the writing of the Rambam around Christianity. The Rambam had some positive things to say about Christianity, but theologically speaking, the Rambam, and this is the exclusivist camp, believed that Christianity is out and out idolatrous. For the Rambam, that was his view. The Rambam believed that the Trinity was inherently a heretical belief from a Jewish perspective. This notion of one that is three and three that is one, the Rambam was a proponent of pure simplicity. The Rambam was very much a pure monotheist. This is consistent with his general thought. The Rambam insisted that essentially needs to be a pure conception of God. He was aligned actually with many of the Islamic thinkers of his time. Christianity, for the Rambam's pure monotheism, was completely out. What's fascinating, though, is that the printed text of the Rambam did not always reflect this. So we're going to see some examples of discrepancies between what the Rambam initially wrote and then what was published and now what we've come back to, where we'll see different editions of the Rambam's writing now have different accounts or different content because some have put it back in on the basis of historical argument. This was what he wrote. And others have said, this is not the Mishnah Torah, this is not the Rambam's writing that we've received. So this became the source of tremendous dispute. So for instance, if you take a look at the Mishnah and Masechet Avodah Zarah, this is always a humorous joke. You ask someone what they're studying, and say, well, I'm learning Avodah Zarah. Right? not what it sounds like. So if you learn Avodah Zarah, you know that the Gemara says that in order to be a member of the Sanhedrin, to be a member of the highest court, you had to study all the different languages and you had to be familiar with all the other faiths, because how could you rule on matters of idolatry? So you had to study Zoroastrianism and you had to study like all these things in order to be a Talmudic scholar. It's a fascinating kind of thing. So you had these people who spoke 70 languages. I mean, these were Renaissance men. You had to be in order to qualify. Fascinating. So the Mishnah of Azaris describes or lists a number of holidays, which it calls the Yemei Edehem, the holidays of the Gentiles.
Just to mention, it's interesting that they had to be Renaissance men, like you say, whereas nowadays people who are fundamentally religious are completely isolated from everything. They have the most narrow view of the world.
Right. Yes, you picked up on my implication.
May I interject with an anecdote? 100 years ago, Rabbi Levine and I found ourselves next to each other. We were both walking in to a Simchat Bat, and in the courtyard, not the courtyard, the garden of the family, there was a statue of a boy. It was a fountain. The boy was spitting water. So under his breath, but I was standing right next to him, the rabbi says, I wonder if that's Avodah Zarah. I think he probably said it jokingly. So I said, oh, Rabbi, you know these people. That's not Avodah Zarah. He said, let me tell you the following story. Years ago, he was going to visit his father in Pardes Chana, and his father was the rabbi, you know. And he prepared, because apparently Avodah Zarah is a very complicated masechta, so he wanted to show how learned he is to his father's community, so his father would be proud. So he wrote to his father that he's studying Masechta Avodah Zarah in order to give a talk to his community. So his father writes back or calls back and says, Avram, we're a community of simple farmers. we don't study Avodah Zarah. In your community, with all the intellectuals, you study Avodah Zarah. Just mentioning it.
There we are. Some things have never changed. I hold that intellect's good to be. I think it's good to be a thinking person.
I just commented. I thought it was very funny.
Yeah, it's interesting. Last time we visited the Amish, we went to Amish country, and they're not permitted to have educations beyond the 8th grade. And it's a philosophical principle, because they believe that understanding leads to arrogance, and therefore is to be eschewed, which is interesting. And there's a kernel of something there, but I don't think that means therefore we shouldn't learn. But with learning comes knowledge, with knowledge comes power, and with power comes, sometimes it gets shared. So it's a good reminder. But yes, nothing has changed in Philadelphia. That's about right. So the Mishnah says, Ve'ilu Yedin Shalach, and these are the holidays of the Gentiles. So look at some of these names, might be familiar. Kalanda might not be familiar, but the next one might look familiar. All right, can anyone make out the next one in the Hebrew? Or even in the English? Yeah, there you go. That's Saturn. Okay. So this is a pagan deity, right? I'm talking about it. Right? Yeah, initially. Absolutely. And then there's some others, Kartasim, and the birthday of the king, and so on and so forth. So why is this relevant? So the Mishnah of Rezara teaches that on these holidays that it's prohibited to engage in commercial transactions with these tribes or these nations, because of the concern that the items that I sell or that I give in exchange, or the money that I give in exchange for this commercial transaction might be used in the worship of the pagan deity or what have you. And that's one of the major rules in Masechet Avodah Zarah. And much ink was spilled over the centuries trying to determine who exactly were these individuals and were the practical ramifications. I mean, if Christianity, just think this through, if this refers to Christianity, what are you going to say? So that Sunday would be their holiday, presumably, right? And by the Middle Ages, everyone had moved over to the Christian Sabbath was on Sunday. And then the 3 days before, and according to some opinions, 3 days after, but certainly 3 days before, it's half the week you can't. I mean, that's not feasible for Jews in the Middle Ages and Christian Europe. So what do you do with this? What are we talking about? So the Rambam, who does not live in Christian Europe, the Rambam is born in Cordoba, Spain. He's born at the very end of the sort of the golden age of Spain, and it's under Islamic rule, and then he travels and eventually comes to Cairo, but it's essentially, there are some Christians, but it's predominantly Muslim. So the Rambam has, perhaps some would say, the capacity, realistically speaking, to take a stringent position. But take a look. So the first one I gave you is the way that Maimonides' commentary to this Mishnah was traditionally published. So it was simply written as follows: Elu hazmanim hanizkarim, these days that were aforementioned dates, hayu mefursamim beoto hazman yitzlav deko chavir anavim aliham, were widely publicized at that time with the idolaters and those dependent to them. So on the printed version of the Rambam, what does it sound like we're talking about? Who's the subject of this Mishnah? Is it contemporary? Is it ancient? Who are we talking about? Right. What does he say? He says, Be'oto hazman. At what time? Right? Right, at that time. In other words, it sounds like from the printed or censored version of the Rambam, some ancient tribe, that's not relevant anymore, it's not practical for us. That's not what the Rambam wrote. What the Rambam actually wrote was as follows. He wrote, Elu hachagim hanizkarim hayim mefursamim yoto hazman itzel hanotzrim. Yeah, he said those times, but with regard to the Notzrim, which is of course Hebrew for the Nazarites, or Nazarenes, right? Or in other words, right, the Christians, right? Notzrim is Hebrew for Christians. That's clear, because that was considered his birthplace, according to at least some accounts in the Gospels. Any holiday regarding any nation, if they were idolatrous, i.e. like the Christians, these same laws would apply. And he continues, he says, and know that this Nazarene nation that stands by its messianic claims, messianic claims. This is not subtle. This is pretty clear cut, right? With all its varied denominations, and the Rambam recognizes the diversity. Just like people who don't necessarily know the Jewish community, they say, like, what do Jews believe about X? When we went to that Amish home, that was, they didn't understand this, so they didn't appreciate the subtleties. So they asked us, do Jews watch television? That was their question for us. Can you imagine if someone wanted to know, do Jews watch television? What would you answer? What?
Yes and no.
I mean, do Jews? They didn't ask Judaism. They said, do Jews?
Then, overwhelmingly, yes.
I mean,
except most do.
But you would have to give them a whole lecture on, right, on contemporary Judaism. There's no way around it. So that was their question for us. So, you know, the Rambam understands the subtleties. He says there are different denominations of Christianity. This is before, obviously, the Reformation. But even then, there were different. There are different beliefs around the Trinity and other key theological questions. But the Rambam says it doesn't matter for these purposes. Kulam Odei Avodah Zarah. They're all idolatrous. Vedeim Kulam Asurim. And their holidays are all prohibited in commercial transactions. And this is a phenomenon, this is a pattern that recurs in the Rambam's writings, where the Rambam wrote explicitly that Christianity equals idolatry from a halachic perspective, but the printed versions of the Rambam's writing did not appear as such. So you have another example, not in his commentary to the Mishnah, but it's his halachic compendium, known as the Mishneh Torah. So in the laws of idolatry, Chor v'zarah peretet halacha dalid. So again, printed, it says, it's based on the Mishnayot and the Gemarot. And the Rambam says, "Kenanim ovdei avodei kochavim b'mazalot source for him the yom rishon hu yom edam." He says the Canaanites are idol worshippers. And by the way, what's the day of their holiday? Sunday. It just happened to be that the ancient Canaanites celebrated Sunday. Isn't that quite the coincidence? Nothing to do with today, of course. That's how the Rambam's Mishneh Torah was printed for hundreds upon hundreds of years, because the Rambam's writing very quickly spread. He might have been writing in the Sephardic or Islamic milieu, but it very quickly spread to France and to Germany. Those were Christian lands already. And then the Reconquista and Christians pushed down from the north of Spain, and they take over the country once again over the course of the 13th, 14th, 15th centuries. And so the Rambam's writings are being read in Christian Europe. And you can't write that. Right? And Jews don't have their own printing presses, right? This time everything had to be done through, and everything was subject to the hand of the censor in Christian countries. This is kind of something they just had to change it, otherwise you're not gonna get any of the Mishneh Torah published and you run the risk of a pogrom. It's just not worth it. So that's what they did. But again, here too, right, if you go to source 5, sometimes, right, Hanotzrim Ovdei Avodah Zarah, right? Hanotzrim. So it was printed as Hakananim, and here you have Hanotzrim, and this is a pattern that recurs. By the way, some versions of this section of Mishneh Torah, they just skip this halacha altogether. That's a third variation that you have, because it just looks so awkward. Can you, the Canaanites, they celebrate Sunday. Like, well, what kind of fool do you take me for? Just leave the whole thing out. It's just not worth it.
Where did the uncensored versions come from?
That's a great question. So we have a lot of stuff from the Geniza, the Cairo Geniza. Okay. We have not everything, but we have major chunks of the Mishneh Torah from there. And that's one of the major sources for accurate information. Yeah, that's what we've learned from the Cairo Geniza. It's stunning. Yeah. It's really remarkable.
If it's left out completely, you mean the whole paragraph is left out?
Yeah, halakha dalet is left out. Oh. Not the whole paragraph, but it skips from gimel to hay. And but you actually, it's fascinating because they didn't renumber them in a lot of them. But the censors didn't know. It was gimel hay. They didn't know the Hebrew alphabet or what have you. So gimel hay, okay, whatever. To suspect.
It makes it obvious.
What?
It makes it obvious.
Yeah, but like, what are they going to, the Jews, you know, they'll say, like, oh, he just, you know, he left something out. It's an innocent mistake, you know. Even the great Maimonides made mistakes once in a while, you know. We recognize that Jews are imperfect, and, okay, you know, like that. Okay, you have this elsewhere. The Rambam insists elsewhere not only that Christianity is idolatrous, but that Islam is not. And that's very clear as well. And this is, again, our focus for next time. But that's very clear. So, for example, in the laws of forbidden foods, so he says that a ger toshav, which is someone who lives in Israel and accepts the seven Noahide commandments, so the general laws of Gentile wines do not apply in the same way to a ger toshav, to such an individual. And he says the fourth line there in the Hebrew, v'chem kol akum, she'ino uvid avodah kocham mazala, meaning any Gentile who is not idolatrous, such an individual, kigon elu hayishmeilim, writes the Rambam. Right, such as these Muslims. The Rambam writes very clearly that Muslims are not considered to be idolatrous. And again, for the Rambam, this was feasible for his community, because he's not outlawing his community in any of these practices. Whereas, we're going to come in a moment to the Balei HaTosafot, to the Tosafists. The Tosafists are writing in France and Germany, which is Christian Europe, and they're money lenders, and they're engaged in commerce and business and so on and so forth. And we already know that the Jews have very few professional opportunities that were available to them, so we have much more limited options. The Rambam, though, doesn't suffer from that problem. That's not his issue. And he maintains, again, consistent with the general philosophical view, this purest kind of perspective. There is a fascinating, also censored passage in the Rambam that we're going to look at today, and the next time, context of Islam. There's another one we're going to have to look at that seems to have a very negative view of Islam and Christianity, and it's very interesting. That was written to in a polemical context. So that'll be for next week.
Because but, here he seems to be very clear that Islam is not in the same category.
And that seems to be the case. In a letter to a suffering community, Gerat Teiman, we'll see, it was a community that was tempted by false messiahs and who were trying to convert entire Jewish community to Islam. And they were deeply confused and they were struggling, and they write a letter to the great light of that generation, to Maimonides, give us some wisdom, give us some advice. And in that context, he has very, very strong things to say, because it's a polemical document, and so he lashes out. It's very interesting. And to put that alongside, we'll have to see that, but that's especially relevant to Islam, so we'll have to come to that next time. But there is one other passage relevant both to Islam and Christianity, which was also censored out of Mishnah Torah, but seems to see theologically a positive role to Christianity and Islam in this world. And this is the second to last chapter of all of Mishnah Torah. So Mishnah Torah is 14 major volumes, and each one has many, many, many halachot. I mean, it's huge, like 70 some odd sections of halachot. And toward the very, very end, the laws of kings, Hilchot Melachim Perikid Aleph, which is the penultimate, second last chapter, and the Rambam is describing basically the halachot of Mashiach. That's the discussion. The last two chapters of the Hilchot Melachim are about Hilchot Mashiach. Basically, if you have to know, if someone comes along, like happened with this community, or happened with Jesus, or what have you, right, Bar Kochba, right? So like Omer is coming up. Someone comes forward and says, I am the Messiah, Messianic claimant, which was not uncommon at that time. What do you do? How do you know? Right? Do you just... Right, so we're Jews, so we just fight. Okay, so right, that's the Rambam, right? The Rambam doesn't have, I guess, such a sense of humor. So he doesn't quite say it that way. But he gives you guidelines, actually. It's quite remarkable. In the course of those guidelines, so he says, for example, this is Perikid Aleph Halacha Dalet. So ours basically go through, in Perikid Aleph, chapter 11, they go through Dalet and Hey. This one's easier, because they didn't have to skip Halachot, because the ones that were censored out were the last section of the chapter. So they didn't have to skip from 3 to 5. They just omitted 6 through 9. It was very easy. It's not a problem. Most of the printed Mishnah Torahs have only the beginning of this. So said if a king arises from the house of David, if he's fitting of observance, is very important for other discussions, and he compels the Jewish people to observe the halachot, and he has to be a warrior, he has to fight the wars of God. So it's like this warrior Torah giant, kind of, right? Like the way that we think of maybe, right, of a David HaMelech or something like that, right? The Hezder, this is the Yeshiva Hezder model. And it's very, very beautiful and very powerful. And he says he's going to come, he's going to inspire all of humanity to worship God. That's going to be the Messiah. Okay, then, if you jump to the next page, he says, but if he dies, right, so this is, right, this is a dig already at Christianity, right, if he dies, right, and this seems to be the proof from the Rambam, that the Rambam rules at least that once someone has died, they can no longer be Messiah. You can't have a Messiah that can come back from the dead. often said in context of those discussions as well. It says if he dies, then you got to go elsewhere. That's basically what it says. Okay. And then if you come to Halacha Vav, right, he adds, and again, this appears in the newfangled, or the original version that we've now found of the Rambam. He writes, Af Yeshua HaNotzri, right? Even Jesus the Nazarene, Shedima Sheyihi HaMashiach, who imagined himself to be the Messiah, V'neherag V'destin. Now you know why it was censored, because the Rambam seems to be saying here, right, that the Jews killed Jesus, which is a matter of great dispute, not only out there, obviously, but even within the Jewish tradition. But that's his claim. Kfar Nabedo Bo Daniel, right? You can imagine this cannot be published in Christian culture in the Middle Ages, right? I mean, come Easter and you put this out there, like, it's right, it's over, you're done, we're grown, there's nothing else to talk about. So he says Daniel already prophesied about him, and then he says that he was described as a violent man, and he came to, if you read the English, jump over right after where it says Daniel 11:14, says, and is there a greater, for the sake of time, is there a greater failure than this? All of the prophets spoke of the Messiah, the Redeemer of Israel, and their Savior, and the gatherer of the captives, and the strengthener of their mitzvah, but this one, Jesus, caused Jews to be lost by the sword, and for the remnants to be scattered and humbled, and to change the Torah. Right, which many scholars now think it was Paul, not Jesus, but that was the Rambam's assumption. She is the Torah, and for the majority of the world to do wrong by worshiping a God other than God. A God other than God, because for the Rambam, Christianity is, of course, idolatrous. Now check this. But the plans of the Creator of the world, no person can understand them. For our ways are not the same as his ways, our plans are not his plans. Meaning, Christianity is idolatrous. But you know what? This is part of God's master plan. Unbelievable. How so? And all these things about Jesus of Nazareth and about that Ishmaelite, he can't even say Muhammad's name. I'll say it for him, you'll forgive me. That Ishmaelite who rose after him. Remember, when the Rambam was a kid, there was a radical sect of Muslims who arose and displaced the more tolerant group, right? The Almohades, they rose to power in roughly 1147, and they drove the Rambam and his family from Cordova when he was 8, 9, 12, something like that years old, and he spent the first half of his life essentially as a refugee. And so the Rambam understands that although there were many more enlightened Muslims at that time, and generally Muslims treated Jews more favorably than Christians, that wasn't a universal truism in the Middle Ages. In the Rambam's own experience. So that Ishmaelite who was after him, they're only to make the path for the King Messiah straight and to fix the whole world for worshiping God together, as it is said, for I will give the peoples clear speech for them all to call out the name of God and to worship him with one purpose. How? The whole world is already filled with the words of the Messiah and the words of the Torah and the words of the Mitzvot. And these words have been spread on distant islands into many peoples of uncircumcised hearts. And they deal with these words. And with the mitzvot of the Torah, they say these mitzvot were true, but they are already fulfilled in this time. They aren't applicable forever. And they say these are things hidden in them, and they're just not just a simple meaning, and the Messiah already came and revealed their secrets. So in other words, they accept part of the truth of the Torah, but then they somehow bastardize it, right? In a way that's incorrect. It's problematic. And when the King Messiah arises for real and he succeeds and he's lifted up and exalted, they will immediately return and will know that their ancestors passed down lies to them and that their prophets and their ancestors made them do wrong. So the Rambam says, Christianity is idolatrous, and both Christianity and Islam are terribly problematic, but you know what? They're part of God's master plan. Here was Paul, essentially. Here were the early Christians, and they took ideas that are at least sympathetic to a monotheistic worldview, and they spread them to these pagan tribes that were polytheistic, that were the most distant philosophies that you could possibly conceive of relative to the true beliefs, as the Rambam of the Torah. and they did our work for us. They helped pave the way for the coming of Messiah. True, they believe that God's word has already been fulfilled. True, they believe that we no longer have to actually implement the laws of the Torah. But don't worry, because Mashiach's going to come, and now his job's relatively easy. You know that scripture you believe in? It's true, at least the first one. You know all those stories about the patriarchs and the matriarchs? Those are also true. And you know what it says in Revelation, and you accept that? You're right about that. The only thing is, it's still relevant, right? Just drop the supersessionism and accept this Messiah instead of the other Messiah. It's basically a wash, right? And this Trinity thing, right? Okay, that's idolatrous, so drop that too. These are fundamental changes, but we do understand the truth is that Christianity, even for the Roman, though it's idolatrous, is much closer, theologically speaking, to traditional Jewish beliefs. So here's the Rambam, idolatrous, 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 and yet sees this sort of from a broader perspective as paving the way toward Messiah. By the way, this also raises fascinating discussions about a separate topic, namely the question of the decline of the generations. You're familiar with this phrase, Yuridas Adoros? Right, this idea, this traditional Jewish idea, and you have this in the Gemara. The Gemara says, well, if the previous generations were like angels, we're like humans. And if the previous generations were like humans, we're just a bunch of donkeys. Forgive me, the Gemara says. And these kinds of things. You have these statements in the Gemara. They say the further that we are from Sinai, the less enlightened we are, the less knowledgeable, the less pious, and so on and so forth. But this seems to be an inversion of that. Right. Isn't the Rambam saying, well, it used to be paganism. It used to be right, that we believed in all sorts of different gods. And that's been refined through God has ensured that through Christianity and Islam, we've come closer to pure monotheistic belief. So this seems to invert the whole notion of the decline of the generations, and there's been a substantial literature about this. Where the Rambam fit in? Rav Kook also seems to have seen us as moving in a positive trajectory toward Mashiach. The Rambam and Rav Kook aren't often seen together, because one, the former was a pure rationalist, and Rav Kook was more mystically inclined, but in this regard, actually, there's some significant concurrence. So this Rambam really helps to soften, if you will, or to kind of repackage the whole notion of Christianity as idolatrous, and yet it's out there. And for the sake of fairness, it should be noted that it wasn't just the Rambam. This really, most Sephardic Rishonim held this way, many Ashkenazic Rishonim also held this way, in other words, medieval scholars. So for example, just so that it's all out there, the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah refers to these minim, or heretics, Yud Zayin Aleph, at source 8. Who are these minim? So Rashi, for example, I give you to turn to the next page. Rashi says, Haminim, top of page 6 now, Ha'anashim asher hafchu, this also was censored. Rashi is also censored at times. Ha'anashim asher hafchu divrei Elokim chayim l'ra'a, people who turned the words of the living God into evil. Kigon, for example. So what does the censored version of Rashi read? Seduke muvaitusen. Right, the Sadducees, right? These guys are Second Temple sects. Way back when, right? Because Rashi's writing. We don't know when he writes this. Rashi dies in 1105. The First Crusade comes through France and Germany. Especially Germany, Rashi's in France, but still there's a traumatic impact in 1096. So we don't know if he writes this before or afterward, but we know what the environment was. It wasn't exactly a pleasant one. So they had to leave it out. But if you take a look, the censored version of Rashi, right, I guess I gave you the Ritva, who cites it, who's a Sephardic Rishon, says, Aval ilu ha-notzrim ha-yishme'ilim, says, right, it's talking about, he actually says notzrim and yishme'ilim, which we're going to have to come to next week. But Rashi himself, Chumash Pirish Rashi, ha-minim talmidei yeshu ha-notzri. So printed Rashi says the Sadducees and the Maitusim. And the actual Rashi that we have, that was the original manuscript that we have, said the students of Jesus, the Nazarene. So again, you have this, the same kind of thing. And this Ritva himself, this Ritva seems to have, Yom Tov Ashbili is a 13th century Spanish scholar. He seems to include the Ishmaelites as idolatrous. That's very curious. Christians believe in the Trinity. Islam, right? Purely monotheistic. And in fact, if anything, Muslims are more extreme, one could argue, in the purity of their monotheism than Jews in certain respects, at least when it comes to icons and so on and so forth. They're even more stringent than we are in these matters. So what does it mean to call Islam idolatrous or heresy, heretical? What does it mean to be heretical? Is it only a question of your conception of God, or are there other elements if we have other fundamental disagreements? Right? If, let's say, someone came to you and said, give your life, right? Or is the question that came up in the Middle Ages. A Muslim says, worship my God, or I will take your life. Unfortunately, these were real scenarios. So when it came to Christianity, it was generally a given. You give your life. What if it's Islam? Atheistic. It's not so simple. But it's a different faith. It doesn't feel...
Given the fact that we have so many names for God, with conceptually that these are different facets of God.
Yeah.
Nobody made that parallel with Christianity, that the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost are different facets of...
Yeah, well, yeah, we're going to talk about that. And some think, this is very charged, I'm about to say, but some think that it's not all that different, or at least some have raised the question, how is this different than the Sfirot of the Kabbalah? Because, you know, in Kabbalah, they divide the Godhead into 10 different sections. Well, is that really so different than say there's one, but there are three, there's one, but there are 10 different? So this is, so in the anti-Kabbalistic polemics of the Middle Ages, they used to say you're no different than the Christians. So you're equally heretical. That's those who are opposed to Kabbalah, right? That's it. So how do they respond? How do they defend Kabbalah? We're going to see a Kabbalistic passage along these lines in a few minutes, but some said, well, it's actually just a metaphor. We don't actually believe that the Godhead is divided into 10 sections. That would violate Maimonidean purity. That's not a theology that we can ascribe to. And the Christians take it more literally. And others said, Christianity is wrong and is theologically odious, and we reject it, but not necessarily because of this. Right? Or we think it's wrong, the Trinity, but Trinity is not inherently idolatrous. That's a very, again, that's very controversial, but that's exactly what we're discussing over here.
And by the way, it turns out that Reform, quote-unquote, Hindus also believe that all these gods are really... segments of the one God.
So we're going to talk about that. It was a very common medieval conception. So we're going to talk about that. And there's reason, I mean, if you read Chumash, it kind of sounds like that sometimes. At least in your local land, there might have been a lower God that was in charge of this. So why is that different? Well, the answer is no. They believed that there was some sort of power, but that was an intermediary that ultimately answered up to the higher God. So in our world today, we don't usually think in these terms, but that was actually very much, as the world transitioned from paganism into more of a pure monotheism, these were intermediary positions that were actually quite common in many parts of the populace. But the Rambam really represents probably the majority medieval position, which is to view Christianity as idolatry. And this troubled the Tosafists to no end. Because the Tosafists were not so much thinking about this philosophically, but they were the halachic leaders of the French and German medieval Jewish communities. This is a Christian context. Are you really going to say with Mishnah Avodah Zarah in practice that you can't engage in commercial transactions on Sunday or for the 3 days prior to that? Okay, so Shabbos is not so much of an issue, but we're going to say for Thursday, Friday, and Sunday. I mean, there's no, you can't support yourself Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. It's just not practical. It's not feasible. It just wasn't going to work. And not only that, but the Tosafists believe very strongly in the piety of their communities. This is a major, major strand that we find among many of the great Talmudic scholars that are living at this time, especially in Christian lands, especially in Ashkenazic context, the fundamental belief in the goodness and the righteousness of their community. If our community practices something, then there's good reason to think that's a data point in its own right. That might be evidentiary to assume that this is correct. And so they came to defend the halachic practices called a limud zchut. It's even stronger than that. Limud zchut would mean, I'm going to find some place for you to hang your hat. You know, maybe I can come up with some circuitous, creative halachic reasoning to say, well, it's not completely absurd. This is even further. How do we justify this behavior? So the Tosafists came along and they strove to justify this. And in particular, one of the things in addition to the commercial transactions was a case of a Jew who wanted to sue a Christian and bring them to court. And this became a real issue. because maybe the Jew can get away without taking a vow in the name of the Savior, right? Something like that. But I can guarantee you exactly what the Christian would have said when they take put their hands on the Bible and they swear in court. They're going to swear in court that what they're saying is true in the name of the Lord, right? In Latin, the whole nine yards, right? The Lord, Savior, right? They would say Jesus Christ. That's how they would say it. So wait a second. In halacha, we know, and not only am I not permitted to violate a sin, but I'm not allowed to cause someone else to sin. Well, if I sue my Christian friend in court, then what I'm going to end up doing is compelling them to invoke the name of a God that I don't believe in, that I don't accept. Is that halachically permissible or not? That's not such a simple matter. So there are two passages in Tosfos that I only give in the Hebrew. I'm not going to read inside right now. But just so you know, that the basic thrust, we need just a drop of it toward the end of it. Basically, the thrust of, among other arguments of Tosfos, especially Rabbi Nutam, the great grandson of Rashi, right, the outstanding grandson of Rashi, Rabbi Nutam insists, he says, well, it's not exactly idolatrous, or it's not as theologically problematic as you might think. Why? So he says, even though they're taking vows, he says, Ve'afal pi, 7 lines from the bottom on page 6, just the last couple lines of Hebrew, and I'll translate it. Ve'afal pi shemashem askirini mohem shem shamayim. Even though they mention together with their God the name of heaven, right, or they, together with their vow the name of heaven, v'chavanatam l'devar acher. Their intention is to something other than what we accept. They're referring not to our God, but to theirs, right? The Christians. Mikol makom, he says, nonetheless, in ze shem avodah kochavim. He says, it's not really the name of idolatry. Gam da'atam lo se shemayim. Right? Their intention is also to the creator of heaven. In other words, the same God that we read about in the Bible, it's the same God that they're thinking of when they take their vow. The God of the Christians is the God of the Jews. It's the same basic belief system. So he says, "V'afal pi shemeshatfim shem shamayim edevar acher." Aye, but what about the Trinity? This is called shituf. Shituf means if you can join God's name with another power. You put someone or something else, another entity, in the same sentence, in the same breath as the God that we believe in. So this is a medieval concept that sort of this intermediary category. It's not pure paganism. It's not there are two independent divine powers that both run the world, but it's also not pure monotheism. There's a God, but as part of that God, there's another power that's associated with it, or there's a Holy Spirit, and so on and so forth, that's also part of this divine conception. So he says, Lo ashkechan da asro legrom la'achirim, says, we do not find that it's prohibited to cause others, lishatef, to engage in what he calls shituf, to partner, to pair God's name with another divine force. And he adds, Velifni Iver Leka, the prohibition against placing is metaphorical stumbling block before a blind individual. Leka does not apply, nerds, I'm not causing the Gentile to sin. Divnei Noach lo huzeru akach, because Gentiles are not prohibited against this combined invocation. So Tosfos, on the surface at least, seems to be saying something theologically radical that's quite different than the Rambam. The Rambam, on the other hand, said straight idolatry. And comes along Tosfot here and elsewhere in Sanhedrin and Bechoro, and they say that no, actually what you're doing is something that's in between. He says it's what we call shituf. It's not pure monotheism, but it's not pure polytheism either. And he says like this. He says, shituf is prohibited for Jews. But no one ever said that shituf is prohibited for Gentiles. Mm-hmm. This is a stunning statement. Pure monotheism is obviously the ideal. Pure polytheism, that's straight out idolatry for everyone. What about shituf? What about one divine power, but with other elements that are attached to it that also have some sort of power as well? It says, that's an in-between category, Jews versus Gentiles. This was a very powerful statement because it was a real game changer in many regards. Because it's one thing to justify common practice, but to give a theological rereading, as it were, was very far-reaching. And this is cited by many. The Ramar of Moshe Isserles, the great codifier of Ashkenazic practice, he codifies this ruling of Tosfot, by the way, as opposed to Shulchan Aruch. Rav Yosef Karo, who represents the Sephardic tradition, he goes back to the Rambam. He seems to say idolatry. But the Rambam, Rav Moshe Isser Liswa, I give you in source 13, he basically cites the perspective of the Tosfot, which seems to indicate again that this in-between category of Shituf might be prohibited, even idolatrous for a Jew, but not so for a Gentile. This became highly controversial. Is this really legitimate? Is it really logical to create this intermediary category and then to say, well, Jews and Gentiles are different? Why should they? Is it so obvious that there should be this distinction between the Jews and the Gentiles? How do we understand that? To the point that it led a whole school of thought to deny that this is what Rabbi Nutam had in mind. So many, many, many scholars say this as well. I gave you an example in source 14. I'm not going to read inside now. The Noda B'Yehuda. This is the great rabbi of the community in Prague, Rav Yechezkel Landau, writing in the 19th century. And Rav Yechezkel Landau, he insists, he says, that's not what Tosfot had in mind. That's not what the rabbi had in mind. So what were they saying? So he limits it. And he says, actually, and again, there's a whole school of thought that goes along with this. He says, really what they're saying is as follows. Of course it's true that the theological belief of full-fledged shituf, in other words, the part of this Trinity belief, that would be genuinely problematic even for Gentiles. What are we saying here? No, when the Gentile says this, he's not really expressing a faith commitment. You know, like, you just go to court and you just put your hand where, you know, wherever it goes, and you just, you know, you say what you need to say. Like, it's not, you know, you're not going to church to say it. It's not a baptism. It's not like, you know, you're going to court. You're really there to defend yourself in court. That's really your interest. And when you're there, you take a vow, or you mumble the words under your breath, whatever. It's not really a theological statement. So what's Tosos saying? Tosos is saying there's an additional prohibition against invoking. It's not about the belief. It's about invoking the name of God together with other names. It says, new lo tishava, not taking a vow in the name of other gods, that was said with regard to the Jews and not with regard to Gentiles. But the actual belief, he says, would be theologically problematic. So he tries to limit this perspective, but it's not clear. And the face reading of Tosfot and the face reading of Rabbeinu Tam is probably not that way. It's probably like the simple reading of the Rama. He, by the way, he reinterprets the Rama as well. He says the Rama also is saying this, but that's the position of the Noda B'Yehuda. I gave you, along these lines, the next source, this is on page 9, this is Rav David Kimchi. And this is just one example of many, many instances in which, going back to the simple reading of Tosfot, we find the distinction between sort of a pure monotheistic belief and this idea that you can then append God's names to other gods, and that whole notion. So Radak, David Kimchi, he's writing in Provence. Provence is in southern France, and he's writing in the 12th and 13th centuries. So Radak writes, he says as follows. He says, "Afal pish ovdim," this is on the verse in Malachi. Malachi is one of my favorite sections of Tanakh. It's the very end of Tanakh. Malachi is the final, the last prophet that's recorded ever in the history of the prophets. He's the last one. It's the second temple period. It's the second Beit HaMikdash. Probably about 50 years in. The last record of a full-fledged nevuah. Very interesting. So he says something very unusual in the first chapter. He says, "Ki gadol shmi bagoyim," he says. He says, you know, he says, the Kohan and the priests who are active in the Beit HaMikdash right now, they're not really so committed to me. But I'll tell you something. You know who is committed? You go out there. It's like with Yonah. You know, Yonah, like, the Jews won't listen to me, but the people of Nineveh did. And there's one, that's in the one opinion in the Midrash says that's why he refused. In the Gemara already. That's why Yonah refused to go to Nineveh. Because then what's going to happen? Whenever I prophesy to the Jews, they say, oh, they roll their eyes. It means, fat. Get out of here. Go to the people of Nineveh, and I tell them that in 40 days God is going to overturn and destroy their entire city. So, okay, tell us what to do, you know, like that. So it's kind of like, you know, parents, you know, kids listening to other people's parents and not to their own parents. If anyone knows what I'm talking about, or maybe I'm just talking about myself. the same kind of phenomenon. So you have so that's what Malachi is, gives this scathing rebuke to the Jews. He says, "You guys, you know what? You're serving in the Beit HaMikdash, but that's where it ends. You have no genuine commitment. If you go out there, Gadol Shmima Goyim, everyone's worshiping me." So Radak says, "Ki Afal Pi Sheovdim Litzva Hashemayim, even though they worship the celestial." These celestial constellations of the heavens, nonetheless, modimbi, they accept with regard to me the other nations. Shani hasibah harishona, I am. This is an Aristotelian, and then my Maimonidean term. I'm the first cause. Very medieval kind of language, right? I'm the first cause. Right? So, in other words, a fundamentally monotheistic conception. Ela she'ovdim otam lefi da'atam, but they worship them in their way. Emtsa'iyem, that there be intermediaries, b'ni uveinam, between me and them. And the rabbis say that they did exactly this. And what Radak is describing over here is he's describing the piety of the Gentiles. So he says, piety? They're idolatrous. What are you talking about? He says, not exactly. He says, actually, because the Radak presumably is using the Christians of his time to describe what we're talking about over here, to reflect and project that back into the Psukim. He says, actually, maybe it's closer than we think. So to summarize what we've seen so far, is we've seen two fundamentally different schools of thought. The Rambam, probably the majority view, is straight idolatrous, but then the face reading of Rabbi Nachman and Tosafot is that actually it's more complex than that. And if you go now to, if you can skip. Oh, if anyone's interested, I gave you here on page 16. Sorry, some of these copies are small. This is from Dr. Bill's book. This is from a Kabbalist. This is a 13th century Spanish Kabbalist. His name is Rav Yosef Ibn Jikatila. Rav Yosef Ibn Jikatila. I'm on page 10. And he also has this idea. If you take a look, he says something remarkable. If you take a look at the, let's say the top, he says, where it says 82. Anyone sees that? He says, but you should know, he writes, that God gives strength and dominion and the scepter to each minister of the ministers of the nations to judge and adjudicate his people and nation. The ministers are called Elohim, or Elohim, because it judges his nation. No one believe there are these other gods have no power, the gods of the nations, but the power is given to them to judge and sustain their nations. You see what he's saying?
Yeah.
That's a little troubling. What's he saying? He's saying, what?
There are lesser gods.
There are lesser gods now.
Yeah.
At first glance, that sounds like it's really not something within the pale. Maybe it's not. Most people say it's not. He would say, actually, if you read Chumash, it kind of sounds that way sometimes. Elo, right? God is Elokei or Elokim. What does that mean? God is the God of gods. What does that mean? That's clearly, that doesn't sound like a Jewish perspective. Well, maybe God empowered lower gods, and they all report to him. Right, they all report to him, kind of like angels, but just lesser gods, right? So you could imagine sustaining a monotheistic view, even empowering these local gods, as long as ultimately there's one power. Pure dualism is a different story, right? The Zoroastrians believe that there's a god of good and god of evil, and these two forces, not God, right? These two forces in nature and in the world are engaged in a never-ending war. At least they can understand why bad things happen to good people. Right? Theodicy is easy. Right? It's the basic core of belief system that raises questions. But you can understand where that comes from. So you can see, you know, how he might come to this. But it's a remarkable example, I think an extreme example, of this idea of sort of that one god who's in charge and then maybe lower gods. And I think most would reject this, but it is out there in our canon. All right. Last thing I want to do today... And then next time we'll finish up and then we'll turn to Islam, is a third perspective. And I didn't give you a ton of text around this perspective because we could do this all day long. What? The phone was incredibly excited about what we're about to see. That's what they're texting you about the behavior. You know? So this is worthy of a class in its own right. But this is perhaps the most liberal perspective that we seem to find in the Middle Ages in particular. And it's worth highlighting as the last piece today. This is not just to say that it's acceptable or it's not fully idolatrous or to see some silver lining, but an even a more positive statement about the Gentiles who were living at that time. Coming from someone who's living in Christian France, in Provence, southern France. A word of background, Rabbi Menachem Hameiri is a 13th century author. He is one of the great Talmud scholars of his generation. Southern France, for those who might be familiar with the map, is basically divided from both France, which is above it, and Spain, which is below. And Spain's a warmer climate, France is a colder climate. There's a mountain range, the Pyrenees Mountains, which divide between the bulk of France and the bottom of France. And then also Spain was really a different culture, a different environment. So the Jews who were living in southern France are sort of a bridge between Ashkenaz to the north and Sfard to the south during the Middle Ages. They kind of went their own way, and they did their own things. He was very influenced by the Rambam, not Maimonides, but sometimes he had his own ideas. So Meiri writes as follows. He's very troubled by the many, many seemingly discriminatory laws that you find in the Talmud. Says, right, it talks about the obligation to return a lost object to a fellow Jew, but not to a Gentile. Talk about a prohibition against selling land to Gentiles or being overly kind to certain peoples and all these kinds of things that rub us as moderns in ways that, you know, we're not entirely comfortable with. So he addresses this again and again and again in probably 25 to 30 different passages, right? So probably 30 different times in which he again and again and again says, and there's some dispute, but I believe this is very much his opinion, not just because of the concerns of censorship. He says, these laws don't apply today. These laws don't apply today. These laws don't apply today. Those laws, none of these laws apply today. And he says, because we're talking about two different kinds of people. He says, the laws in the Talmud are talking about not just people who are idolatrous, but people who are idolatrous and barbaric. Right? And uncivilized, and people who are not, in his language, gidurim bidarchei hadat, who are not bound by the manners of civilization and society. They engaged and acted in ways that were completely inconsistent with what we view as it means to not be an outstanding human being. He says, that's what we were talking about over here. Not only that, but in some places he goes so far to say that the nations today are not only civilized, but they are monotheistic, he says. And I gave you one small example. He says in source 17, "Umikom akom umod hagduro b'derchei hadatot maminim b'mitzuto yiparech lachduto v'chalto." He says these nations that are gidurim b'derchei hadatot, in other words, they're bound by the ways of society or civilization.
What's that?
I don't know about that.
I mean,
it's an AP.
But he looked like the
bell was for class, not for the APs.
He did.
Oh, you heard drums. I didn't hear.
Yeah, he did live a century after the Crusades.
Good evidence. Good call. I didn't hear.
I mean, he did live.
So why is he? What?
How
why,
could he? I mean, how is his reality?
I have a couple.
I
have a couple theories about this. Theory number one is I once wrote a paper on this. I found evidence that he had a Christian friend. Now we don't know how many Christian friends he had, but there's a, I think his name is Michael Scott, who was a 13th century Provençal Christian scientist, and the Meiri refers to him pretty clearly in one place in his Chibur HaTshuva, his writing on repentance. It's like a 500-page tract, and toward the beginning, the Meiri refers to this relationship, and there's additional evidence that he had personal relationships in a positive and friendly way, in a genuine way, with Christians. That's one. Second, some have minimized the Meiri because they argued that if you take a look, there's scholarly evidence that Christians living at that time were Unitarians. Right? So they were Christian heretics because they were overly monotheistic, who denied the truth of the Trinity, the mystery of the Trinity, and some have suggested, well, that's who he was referring to. So when he says, well, they're purely monotheistic, maybe it means not the Trinitarians, but it means the heretic Unitarians who were living in Provence at that time. There's some evidence for that. So that might be part of it, though, is that he might have actually seen their philosophy as more, their theology is more consistent with the Jewish belief. Either way, he says, but it's not true of the uncivilized peoples. In other words, it sounds like he's saying this about all Christians, irrespective of their beliefs. Professor Moshe Halbertal is a genius, a very brilliant scholar. He wrote a book on the Rambam also, if anyone likes reading about these things. I have it over there on the bookshelf. More than welcome to borrow it. But he wrote about this, and he claims that this is actually consistent with other philosophies that were common at that time. So that's his claim. Meiri has a fascinating reception history as well. Some couldn't believe that he said it, and so they claimed that part of it was actually because of the concern of censorship. Meaning, he added these things in even though he didn't believe in them because he knew that otherwise they might get him in trouble and they might not print his books and they might stir problems in the Jewish community. So, for example, there's a Rabbi Bleich at Cardozo at YU's law school who claims that part of the Rambam's, part of Meiri's view, rather, is actually not genuine. Rabbi Bleich is a great scholar. I think it's wrong. And Professor Halbertal and most scholars think it's wrong. I think it's actually quite convincing that this is his genuine position and that it's due to some of the different things that I've mentioned. Whether or not to accept the Meiri is also a fascinating kind of thing. Let's say most have not accepted the Meiri, but Rav Soloveitchik's younger brother, Aaron Soloveitchik, he embraced it. And what's interesting is if you take a look, for example, at the art scroll, they're very savvy. So if you ask them what they genuinely believe, I don't know. But if you take a look at the notes of the art scroll, they're constantly citing, they say, right, this refers to the ancient Gentiles, the pagans of the time, right? And then they put in parentheses, Rabbi Menachem HaMeiri, close parentheses. And they do this all over the place. They put it in, but this does not apply to today's Gentiles. This does not apply to today's Gentiles. So, when you write a work that's going to be put out there, it's very common to cite it. The Meiri, again, is extremely important, has very wide-ranging ramifications. So what we've seen, there's obviously much more out here, but today this gives us a good grounding, not just around Christianity, but around some basic models of conceptions. You have, to summarize, we've seen two or three basic approaches today. We have the Rambam and the majority medieval thought, which is straight idolatry. Right, in terms of the conception of Christianity. You then have Rabbi Nutam and the Baal HaTosfot, who seem, and I think the more convincing interpretation is to say that no, that there's this, they occupy this in-between category, and you get to the idea of Shituf. And then you have the Meiri, who seems to go even further and say this as a pure monotheism to it, and that has all sorts of significant ramifications for other discussions. What we have left to do is to look at some contemporary or more modern writings, including Rav Hirsch. We have a special surprise from Rav Yom Tov Lipman Heller, and I'm very excited about that because the biographer, does anyone know who the Tosfot Yom Tov's biographer is? I'll give you a hint for those. He lives in Lower Merion. Joe Davis, that's right. Joe Davis, the Harusa. Yeah, Harusa. There you go. Joe Davis is the biographer of the Tosfot Yom Tov. I read his biography about 15 years ago, having never met Joe Davis. I don't know who he is. Some people know who he is.
You don't know who he is?
I didn't. When I read the book 15 years ago, I had never heard Joe Davis. He moved to the community. So I introduced myself to this individual. I say, what's your name? He says, so-and-so. I said, oh, that's a nice name. What are you involved in? What do you do? So he says, I'm involved in academia. So I look at him. I say, any chance you know anything about the Tosfot Yom Tov? He says, actually, I wrote the book. I said, okay, 2 + 2 = 4. So I had to give him a shout out. I'm reading Dr. Brill's book, and I knew he had something that was relevant to this. So I don't have time for it today, but it's going to include him on the source sheet. I have to tell Joe about it and some other sources. And then we're going to have to look at Islam. Islam seems to be purely monotheistic, but the question is, how do we deal with it? Do we view it still as a different faith? And what does that mean? What does that look like? Can you pray in a mosque? Okay, I'll give you a hint. Ma'aras ha-machpelah is a mosque, so Jews daven in there. So, but sure, of course. Anyhow, so we'll have to look at Islam, and then again, I hope to then later come to some of the Eastern religions and where those fit. And Yashar Koach, pleasure as always.
Thank you so much.